Chapter 36. City to Columbus, and thence to Sandusky. So, by Lake Erie, to the Falls of Niagara, as I had a desire, to travel through the interior of the state of Ohio, and to strike the lakes, apostrophe as the phrase is, at a small town called Sandusky, to which that route would conduct us on our way to Niagara, we had to return from St. Louis by the way we had come, and to retrace our former track as far as Cincinnati. The day on which we were to take leave of St. Louis being very fine, and the steamboat, which was to have started I don't know how early in the morning, postponing, for the third or fourth time, her departure until the afternoon, we rode forward to an old French village on the river, called properly Carondelet, and nicknamed Vide Poche, and arranged that the packet should call for us there. The place consisted of a few poor cottages, and two or three public houses, the state of whose larders certainly seemed to justify the second designation of the village, for there was nothing to eat in any of them. At length, however, by going back some half a mile or so, we found a solitary house, where ham and coffee were procurable, and there we tarried to wait the advent of the boat, which would come in sight from the green before the door, a long way off. It was a neat, unpretending village tavern, and we took our repast in a quaint little room with a bed in it, decorated with some old oil paintings, which in their time had probably done duty in a Catholic chapel or monastery. The fare was very good, and served with great cleanliness. The house was kept by a characteristic old couple, with whom we had a long talk, and who were perhaps a very good sample of that kind of people in the West. The landlord was a dry, tough, hard-faced old fellow, not so very old either, for he was but just turned 60, I should think, who had been out with the militia in the last war with England, and had seen all kinds of service, except a battle, and he had been very near seeing that, he added. Very near. He had all his life been restless and locomotive, with an irresistible desire for change, and was still the son of his old self. For if he had nothing to keep him at home, he said, slightly jerking his hat and his thumb towards the window of the room in which the old lady sat, as we stood talking in front of the house, he would clean up his musket and be off to Texas tomorrow morning. He was one of the very many descendants of Cain proper to this continent, who seemed destined from their birth to serve as pioneers in the great human army, who gladly go on from year to year extending its outposts, and leaving home after home behind them, and die at last, utterly regardless of their graves, being left thousands of miles behind, by the wandering generation who succeed. His wife was a domesticated, kind-hearted old soul, who had come with him, apostrophe from the queen city of the world, apostrophe which, it seemed, was Philadelphia, but had no love for this western country, and indeed had little reason to bear it any, having seen her children, one by one, die here of fever, in the full prime and beauty of their youth. Her heart was sore, she said, to think of them, and to talk on this theme, even to strangers, in that lighted place, so far from her old home, eased it somewhat, and became a melancholy pleasure. The boat appearing towards evening, we bade adieu to the poor old lady and her vagrant spouse, and making for the nearest landing place, were soon on board the Messenger again, in our old cabin, and steaming down the Mississippi. If the coming up this river, slowly making head against the stream, be an irksome journey, the shooting down it with the turbid current is almost worse, for then the boat, proceeding at the rate of 12 or 15 miles an hour, has to force its passage through a labyrinth of floating logs, which, in the dark, it is often impossible to see beforehand or avoid. All that night, the bell was never silent for 5 minutes at a time, and after every ring the vessel reeled again, sometimes beneath a single blow, sometimes beneath a dozen dealt in quick succession, the lightest of which seemed more than enough to beat in her frail keel, as though it had been pie crust. Looking down upon the filthy river after dark, it seemed to be alive with monsters. As these black masses rolled upon the surface, or came starting up again, head first, when the boat, in plowing her way among a shoal of such obstructions, drove a few among them for the moment underwater. Sometimes the engine stopped during a long interval, and then before her and behind, and gathering close about her on all sides, were so many of these ill-favored obstacles, that she was fairly hemmed in, the center of a floating island, and was constrained to pause until they parted, somewhere, as dark clouds will do before the wind, and opened by degrees a channel out. In good time next morning, however, we came again in sight of the detestable morass called Cairo, and stopping there to take in wood, lay alongside a barge, whose starting timbers scarcely held together. It was moored to the bank, and on its side, was painted Coffee House. Apostrophe that being, I suppose, the floating paradise to which the people fly for shelter, when they lose their houses for a month or two beneath the hideous waters of the Mississippi. But looking southward from this point, we had the satisfaction of seeing that intolerable river dragging its slimy length, and ugly freight abruptly off towards New Orleans, and passing a yellow line which stretched across the current, were again upon the clear Ohio, never, I trust, to see the Mississippi more, saving in troubled dreams and nightmares. Leaving it for the company of its sparkling neighbor, was like the transition from pain to ease, or the awakening from a horrible vision to cheerful realities. We arrived at Louisville on the fourth night, and gladly availed ourselves of its excellent hotel. Next day we went on in the Ben Franklin, a beautiful mail steamboat, and reached Cincinnati shortly after midnight. Being by this time nearly tired of sleeping upon shelves, we had remained awake to go ashore straightway, and groping a passage across the dark decks of other boats, and among labyrinths of engine machinery and leaking casks of molasses, we reached the streets, knocked up the porter at the hotel, where we had stayed before, and were, to our great joy, safely housed soon afterwards. We rested but one day at Cincinnati, and then resumed our journey to Sandusky. As it comprised two varieties of stagecoach traveling, which, with those I have already glanced at, comprehend the main characteristics of this mode of transit in America, I will take the reader as our fellow passenger, and pledge myself to perform the distance with all possible dispatch. Our place of destination in the first instance is Columbus. It is distant about 120 miles from Cincinnati, but there is a macadamized road, rare blessing. The whole way, and the rate of traveling upon it is 6 miles an hour. We start at 8 o'clock in the morning, in a great mail coach, whose huge cheeks are so very ruddy and plethoric, that it appears to be troubled with a tendency of blood to the head. Dropsical it certainly is, for it will hold a dozen passengers inside. But, wonderful to add, it is very clean and bright, being nearly new, and rattles through the streets of Cincinnati gaily. Our way lies through a beautiful country, richly cultivated, and luxuriant in its promise of an abundant harvest. Sometimes we pass a field, where the strong bristling stalks of Indian corn look like a crop of walking sticks, and sometimes an enclosure, where the green wheat is springing up among a labyrinth of stumps. The primitive worm fence is universal, and an ugly thing it is, but the farms are neatly kept, and, save for these differences, one might be traveling just now in Kent. We often stop to water at a roadside inn, which is always dull and silent. The coachman dismounts and fills his bucket, and holds it to the horses' heads. There is scarcely ever anyone to help him, there are seldom any loungers standing round, and never any stable company with jokes to crack. Sometimes, when we have changed our team, there is a difficulty in starting again, arising out of the prevalent mode of breaking a young horse, which is to catch him, harness him against his will, and put him in a stagecoach without further notice. But we get on somehow or other, after a great many kicks and a violent struggle, and jog on as before again. Occasionally, when we stop to change, some two or three half-drunken loafers will come loitering out with their hands in their pockets, or will be seen kicking their heels in rocking chairs, or lounging on the windowsill, or sitting on a rail within the colonnade. They have not often anything to say though, either to us, or to each other, but sit there idly staring at the coach and horses. The landlord of the inn is usually among them, and seems, of all the party, to be the least connected with the business of the house. Indeed he is with reference to the tavern, what the driver is in relation to the coach and passengers. Whatever happens in his sphere of action, he is quite indifferent, and perfectly easy in his mind. The frequent change of coachman works no change or variety in the coachman's character. He is always dirty, sullen, and taciturn. If he be capable of smartness of any kind, moral or physical, he has a faculty of concealing it which is truly marvelous. He never speaks to you as you sit beside him on the box, and if you speak to him, he answers, if at all, in monosyllables. He points out nothing on the road, and seldom looks at anything. Being, to all appearance, thoroughly weary of it, and of existence generally. As to doing the honors of his coach, his business, as I have said, is with the horses. The coach follows, because it is attached to them, and goes on wheels. Not because you are in it. Sometimes, towards the end of a long stage, he suddenly breaks out into a discordant fragment of an election song, but his face never sings along with him. It is only his voice, and not often that. He always chews and always spits, and never encumbers himself with a pocket handkerchief. The consequences to the box passenger, especially when the wind blows towards him, are not agreeable. Whenever the coach stops, and you can hear the voices of the inside passengers, or whenever any bystander addresses them, or anyone among them, or they address each other, you will hear one phrase repeated over and over and over again to the most extraordinary extent. It is an ordinary and unpromising phrase enough, being neither more nor less than yes, sir, apostrophe, but it is adapted to every variety of circumstance, and fills up every pause in the conversation. Thus, the time is 1 o'clock at noon. The scene, a place where we are to stay and dine, on this journey. The coach drives up to the door of an inn. The day is warm, and there are several idlers lingering about the tavern, and waiting for the public dinner. Among them, is a stout gentleman in a brown hat, swinging himself to and fro in a rocking chair on the pavement. As the coach stops, a gentleman in a straw hat looks out of the window. Straw hat. To the stout gentleman in the rocking chair. I reckon that's Judge Jefferson, and it? Brown hat. Still swinging, speaking very slowly, and without any emotion whatever. Yes, sir. Straw hat. Warm weather, Judge. Brown hat. Yes, sir. Straw hat. There was a snap of cold, last week. Brown hat. Yes, sir. Straw hat. Yes, sir. A pause. They look at each other, very seriously. Straw hat. I calculate you'll have got through that case of the corporation, Judge, by this time, now? Brown hat. Yes, sir. Straw hat. How did the verdict go, sir? Brown hat. For the defendant, sir. Straw hat. Interrogatively. Yes, sir. Brown hat. Affirmatively. Yes, sir. Both. Musingly, as each gazes down the street. Yes, sir. Another pause. They look at each other again, still more seriously than before. Brown hat. This coach is rather behind its time today, I guess. Straw hat. Doubtingly. Yes, sir. Brown hat. Looking at his watch. Yes, sir. Nigh upon 2 hours. Straw hat. Raising his eyebrows in very great surprise. Yes, sir. Brown hat. Decisively, as he puts up his watch. Yes, sir. All the other inside passengers. Among themselves. Yes, sir. Coachman. In a very surly tone. No, it ain't. straw hat to the coachman. "Well, I don't know, sir. We were a pretty tall time coming that last 15 mile. That's a fact." The coachman making no reply, and plainly declining to enter into any controversy on a subject so far removed from his sympathies and feelings, another passenger says, "Yes, sir," apostrophe, and the gentleman in the straw hat, in acknowledgement of his courtesy, says, "Yes, sir," apostrophe to him, in return. The straw hat then inquires of the brown hat whether that coach in which he, the straw hat, then sits, is not a new one? To which the brown hat again makes answer, "Yes, sir," apostrophe, "straw hat. I thought so. Pretty loud smell of varnish, sir." Brown hat, "Yes, sir." All the other inside passengers, "Yes, sir." Brown hat, to the company in general, "Yes, sir." The conversational powers of the company having been by this time pretty heavily taxed, the straw hat opens the door and gets out, and all the rest alight also. We dine soon afterwards with the boarders in the house, and have nothing to drink but tea and coffee. As they are both very bad, and the water is worse, I ask for brandy, but it is a temperance hotel, and spirits are not to be had for love or money. This preposterous forcing of unpleasant drinks down the reluctant throats of travelers is not at all uncommon in America, but I never discovered that the scruples of such wincing landlords induced them to preserve any unusually nice balance between the quality of their fare and their scale of charges. On the contrary, I rather suspected them of diminishing the one and exalting the other, by way of recompense for the loss of their profit on the sale of spirituous liquors. After all, perhaps, the plainest course for persons of such tender consciences would be a total abstinence from tavern keeping." Dinner over, we get into another vehicle which is ready at the door, for the coach has been changed in the interval, and resume our journey, which continues through the same kind of country until evening, when we come to the town where we are to stop for tea and supper, and having delivered the mail bags at the post office, ride through the usual white street, lined with the usual stores and houses, the drapers always having hung up at their door, by way of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.